What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. This is our Friday episode where we're talking about being financially free, financial freedom. Today, I've got Jake with me again from our dental practice team. He's a financial planner and he is a certified student loan professional on our SLP team as well. And today we are going to chat about really the human side of finance and how behavior comes into play way more than we think when it comes to financial planning. It's not really just about the numbers. Welcome, Jake. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on again. Happy Friday, everyone. And I am so excited because this is one of my favorite times of the year. The trees are turning a little orange now. We're recording this in September, but you know, by October, certain parts of the country, it's going to be really nice and mild. We can start having bonfires again. So I'm super happy about that.
So quick thing, I saw on a reel recently, I'm a real person, not TikTok, because I'm a millennial, but we're going to do a bonfire here coming up with a camping trip. And of course, there's s'mores. There's lots of ways that you can like do s'more variations. But I saw where you could do a charcuterie, like fire roasting situation, where basically you put like a block of cheese at the end of your stick, roast it a little bit just to get it melted, and like you kind of drag it against some crackers and stuff. I thought that was the coolest thing ever. So I'm totally going to do that.
Yeah, that sounds great. Speaking of s'mores, my wife loves to absolutely torch her marshmallow.
So she likes them like burnt.
Crisp, like black. Yeah. And everybody like looks at her when we're on a bonfire and like, are you going to eat that? And yeah. she just eats it. And I'm like, I don't know if what that is like a sign of.
A deficiency of something, like yeah. A deficiency of a vitamin.
It's a little scary. But anyway, yeah, we absolutely love bonfire season. So we'll try the charcuterie boards out.
Yeah. Today, I think our topic is pretty casual. It's pretty low. Like, you're not going to have to think a lot when we're talking through this topic because it's really just about behavior. Being in the financial planning industry for a while now, like, it's really great to see our industry evolve a little more over time because I think historically, like, financial planning has been such a old, slow industry, right? Would you say the same?
It really used to be you're going to pay us thousands of dollars for a financial plan. Mm-hmm. We're going to spend hours and hours on this financial plan and give you the mm-hmm. perfect plan for the next 10 years. And we're going to print that out. It's going to be a nice leather-bound book. And we're going to give it to you. And you go do all these things, right? And that's the,
right.
We'll know for a fact you're going to hit that goal that you're talking about, right? The only problem is that we're not rational robots. We're irrational humans. The likelihood of that book sitting on a bookshelf and collecting dust is very high. And you meet back with a follow-up and they haven't even done step one. And so why do you think that is, Megan?
Originally, like, you know, I think in the financial planning space, there's a lot of different areas that you can go into, like studying finance. You can go and be a tax professional. Like you could go the tax route. Those folks are going to tend to be very analytical, very in the weeds with the numbers, which rightfully so, you should be. There's also spectrums with like investments. Like you could go and be somebody who manages a hedge fund, really in the weeds of like investments. And a lot of those professions are not necessarily people facing, where financial planning has increasingly become more people facing, where it's conversation more so, hey, give me the facts and numbers and I'll go back and do the analysis. Behavior has come into play. And to prove this too, like we were just talking about this. So the CFP curriculum to be a certified financial planner, which is kind of like the doctor in the financial planning space, there is now a section on behavioral finance that you're tested on, which we learn all about, like biases or biases, however you say it, plural, and just making decisions, behavior of a client, how to pivot, you know, your plan based on behavior of a client, how to shape behavior or change behavior if there are some detrimental behaviors going on. That I think is really cool because kind of like in fitness, like our last episode, we talked a lot about some similarities between like working out, fitness, and like financial planning. Behavior is a big part of the equation. Like the numbers are, of course, important. Just like, you know, working out, lifting weights is a big part of working out and staying fit and healthy. But behavior is a huge part as well. Just like what you put in your body, like food, when you're talking about a healthy body, that's a big part. That's how I see it right now.
For sure. And it can end up costing you a lot of money. in your financial life. And we'll talk about ways it can cost you money in this podcast, but a lot of times it's just like inaction. It's like, hey, like not executing on the plan. We always talk about like a plan that is executed, even if it's not the perfect plan, is better than the perfect plan that's not executed. A lot of times we just need to get out of our own way and kind of think a little bit more rationally and let our emotions exit the conversation when it comes to our money.
So you're saying I'm the problem, Jake.
Yeah, you're the problem. It's you.
Yes, our good old Taylor Swift lyrics. But that's totally true. And your point earlier was absolutely correct, where like traditionally you go to a financial planner, you say, hey, I have these goals. They go back, do some number crunching and bust out, like you said, kind of like this leather bound plan that could be hundreds of pages long. And it's got everything in there about like how to budget, what insurances to implement as part of your plan, how to start your investment management, your estate planning details, like it's got everything in there. But more often than not, that is very overwhelming for someone who is not in the industry, who doesn't speak the financial speak. And so like you were saying, like a lot of folks just didn't implement the plan and it wasn't as collaborative. It was just like, here's your deliverable, pay me my fee.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
No help or assistance along the way.
Yeah. The other thing is it's probably going to be wrong in another, I don't know, 3 months.
Yeah, exactly. Tomorrow, because things change. And that's a very static thing to print out.
Yeah. Then it's like, oh, you can pay us for a review of the plan and make changes, right? It's like an updated plan, right? It seems like a great business model. And fortunately, that business model is kind of going by the wayside in our industry. And
yeah, it was more like transactional, where it was, here's your deliverable, you know, go implement it. And it was up to you as the person to implement it. This also reminds me of like in my earlier student loan planning days, like when I was doing student loan plans, I admittedly had a really archaic process. And I learned this from the very first firm that I worked at, which was a traditional financial planning firm, where when you're going to meet with a client and present the options, which at the time I was presenting, like, should we be going on repay or IBR? Should we be doing PSLF? You would hate this now, Jake. Like I would print out based my equivalent of the student loan calculator that we use with Student Loan Planner. I would print out the results of that, print out the trajectory, the payment schedule, everything. I'd print it out. It'd be a PDF. And if I was meeting with them virtually, I would present it as a PDF. If I was meeting with them in person, I'd like give them a copy so they could see it too. And we'd review it together. And almost always it was, oh, well, my income is not quite exactly right. Or I think I'm going to make more money later. Or I don't think my income is going to grow as fast. And like immediately those things I have to throw in the trash because they're all of a sudden like not accurate anymore. So when I met Travis, like it was pretty hilarious. We were chatting about our processes and he was like, yeah, we just go through it live. I was like, live? You do it live? It's a collaborative process. He's like, yeah, it's a collaborative process. Like, you know, and even then, like there were things that we were doing back then. Like we would send the spreadsheet over email before we started using Zoom a lot more. COVID folks know, like Zoom exploded in 2020, but we would send the spreadsheet over email and still have to like edit it if we made changes. But we've evolved.
Yeah.
And now like getting to the point, like our financial planning process now is very much like this collaborative idea that we're talking about, where it's not we're throwing down a big plan that's printed out or like static. It's let's talk about your goals. Let's start to plug that into our software. And let's talk about how these things will unfold over time and how these things will change.
Yeah. The last thing you said, these goals are subject to change.
Mm-hmm.
Like with an asterisk, subject to change is what should be at the bottom of every kind of goal list here, because, you know, we're going to aim for these goals. We're going to kind of go through the discovery process with our financial planning process. What is the most important thing to you? Like the number one thing that you want your money to do for you in life. Mm-hmm. And that's going to change without a doubt over time. Now, the goal itself, just the overarching goal might not change, but maybe it's less or more, or maybe the timing changes, or maybe there's another goal that kind of precedes it in 5 years. Maybe something else comes up. As we're kind of going through life, our value system changes.
Mm-hmm.
I always think about what was important to me, I don't know, in my college years. When I was in college, at least for the first part of my college journey, I was working two jobs. I was working at Finish Line, which is it's a national brand, but a shoe store. And I was also working at a vitamin shop at the same time, which is a health supplement store.
Fitting. This is why we talk about fitness so much when Jake's on.
Right. If you think I'm into fitness now, if you would have met me in college, I was very much into it. And so that's my point. I was our best customer. I was one of our best customers at both the stores because my value system was like, hey, I want to look good and I want to wear cool shoes, right? And so like half my paycheck would go to refund my employer for paying me.
Subsidizing your lifestyle with the jobs that you were working.
Right. And now fast forward to now, I have a wife, a child, a beautiful baby boy, and I live in a different state and I never thought that that would happen. And so that just goes to show like everyone can kind of relate back to like, hey, 5, 10 years ago, whatever it might be, what we cared about then is probably way different than what we care about now, especially as someone is like graduating dental school and getting into a practice. And there's just so many different things that have probably happened for a lot of folks.
Yeah, it is really fun to think about. And I'll encourage clients, like when we meet with clients, so SLP Wealth, we've been open for about a year and a half now, but all of us have been in the financial planning industry for years. And I always thought it was really fun to bust out, you know, when we first met with the client, like what did our situation look like at that time? What were our goals at that time? You know, a great, easy way to track progress is to track net worth. So where are we at in our assets, what we're growing, and where are we at with what we owe, our liabilities? And I would, you know, take a snapshot of where we're at when we first got started, which we do at SLP Wealth too. You know, at that time, if it's a year, 3 years down the road, I would be looking at where are we at now and how far have we come? And, you know, in the day-to-day, it's really hard to see progress. Especially if there's a lot of things you're trying to accomplish at once, it feels like it's just a never-ending thing. Like it's kind of overwhelming and it doesn't feel like you're making a lot of progress. But when you look back on like a year or 2 years, like it's incredible to see how far someone can come when they're looking at it with maybe a little bit longer of a timeline or a lens. And that's really exciting and really motivating. And I think kind of going along with what you were saying earlier about that like huge written financial plan, like that's very overwhelming for someone. Analysis paralysis is a true thing. Like a lot of people wouldn't dive in and because it was so overwhelming, they didn't even know where to start. And it's just getting that first step moving, right? Let's just get a step moving in the right direction. The momentum will help us along the way if we could just get started. You know, I think you were saying like even just a couple actions, like if there's 10 recommendations, but we only get to like 2 or 3, that's still huge progress. And we can move towards the rest of those 10.
I relate it to a figurative staircase, right? So like that's years. And all we're doing when we meet with someone is just one step of that staircase. And it's the next 2 or 3 things, 2 or 3 actions that will keep the momentum going towards that end goal. That's subject to change, but all we're worried about is that next step. And then we kind of zoom out over multiple time frames. And we think about all that progress we made up the staircase. And that's what it's all about, right? So it's important to reflect on the journey so far and zoom out. But really our next best thing should be what the next 2 or 3 actions that can get us closer.
Yeah. And having like an accountability partner in this, like how I think financial planning is changing now for CFPs or for firms like ours is it is more collaborative. It is more, we are your accountability partner to check in on, hey, you said you wanted to do this. Where are we at on it? We put together a plan to get there. How are we doing? And sometimes the answer is, you know, I didn't realize I had other priorities that I wanted to put first. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's totally fine. But then other times it's like, I fell off track. I need you to keep me on track, right? Let's redo the numbers. Let's get back, you know, check with me 6 months. I'll be, you know, going in the right direction. So the accountability is really helpful to have somebody like pushing you towards the right direction.
That's exactly right. So if anything, you can look up so much information online nowadays.
Yeah.
But the real kind of value in working with someone that's not you is the fact that they're not you. As crazy as that sounds, because you can be pulled in so many different directions. As humans, like we have so many, like I'm guilty of it. Megan, you're guilty of it. And we're CFPs, right? So we've done our technical background there, you know, just in general, like we get pulled in different directions where we, as humans, it's tough to stay on track. without somebody kind of redirecting you back to the plan.
Distracted or, you know, the next shiny thing. We talked about this a little bit on Sim and I's episode on wealth killers in America. We talked about also how we're marketed to every day, like hundreds, maybe thousands of times a day. And that makes it hard. You know, if we're not grounded in our goals, we're not like continuously like working towards those, like thinking about those things that are important to us, like it's very easy to get distracted and our money is easily spent on things that actually don't matter that much to us. Or was like a clickbaity thing, or I'd talk about unhinged consumerism or overconsumption a lot because it is such a big thing these days, or maximalism, I think is now the word for this.
Yeah, I heard a good saying on that. It said, no one cares as much about the car you're driving than you.
Yeah, that's true.
So if you're buying the nice car, or, you know, that you could be a very big like car person, right? So you love working on cars, you like going to car shows, and that's definitely something that's like a value system. I fully promote that. Mm-hmm. But if you're spending 5% of your time in your car, not even 5%, mm-hmm. but just commuting to work, and you buy a very, very nice car, what are the intentions of the purchase? Is it to impress you, or is it to impress other people? Is that going to help the value system that you talked about before, you know, about your family and retiring early and those things?
Mm-hmm. I think there's another like common saying going around, like, you know, don't buy things to impress people you hate or like people that you don't even like. You know, we talked a lot about that on that episode. So if you missed it, make sure to go back to that one. But let's talk a little bit about behavior to human nature, to like the emotional side of finance, financial planning, finance in general. And I think it starts with just like our own money story, like how we feel about money. And that could be based on all of our collective experiences over growing up, through our early adulthood, through like the beginning of our career. Your money story can really, really, really shape how you feel and how you manage your money.
And you don't even realize it. Mm-hmm. You really don't. This is involuntary feelings or involuntary behaviors that may have been from the way that you grew up. What was your family like when it came to the money conversation? Was the money conversation even a conversation, or was it largely ignored? Maybe you grew up in a more without a lot of income, like in your family. Mm-hmm. And we just kind of were like, going to like the discount, the Dollar General to buy everything because we just, you know, you just had to make ends meet, or maybe you had a single parent, you know, growing up. All of these things involuntarily shape the way that you today think about money, and for better or for worse, because I've definitely had people that like have a scarcity mindset where like, hey, that dollar that I have in my bank account might not be there the next day because that's what it was like when I was a child. So I want to go spend it, because I don't know if it's going to be there the next day. Then there's others that use that on the opposite side of things.
Yeah, I was going to say the reverse, where it's they're scared to spend it.
Yeah, so it's like they use that as like, hey, I want to do better for my kids than what I grew up with. And so they kind of use that on like the other opposite end of the behavior there.
And I think these behaviors too that we have internally, they will expose themselves externally in some form or fashion. Like we're either not saving as much as we should, or we're going into debt because we have that kind of, you know, YOLO mentality. Like we only live once. There's nothing like today. Or we have a ton of money in savings. I think this is actually kind of an indicator of that scarcity, like scared to spend money mentality, where like someone has hundreds of thousands of dollars in their checking account or their savings mm-hmm. account. I've talked before about a client of mine who their dad literally buried cash in the backyard because he didn't want to spend the money. So he hid it from himself. He literally made it very hard to access. These types of behaviors, like they will show up somewhere and they may or may not be helping you. And so there are things that we can look out for, biases we can look out for that we can recognize, you know, not to say that we can prevent every bias or every like bad behavior with money, but we could start to recognize these things and realize, you know, there might be a different way to think about it, or there might be ways to maybe positively make a spin on having that existing behavior or that existing bias.
I'm so glad you brought up the whole cash pile situation.
Yeah.
Not literally in the backyard. I haven't seen that. But I have seen, like you said, six figures, multiple six figures in cash. And I think about the inaction, or at least not putting your money to more work, is a cost in itself, an opportunity cost. And so I think about, like, do you remember in 2022, I think is when they started raising interest rates, and mm-hmm. we just had a rate cut for the first time since 2020, just yesterday from the time we're recording this. But everyone is like, hey, I can get 4%. Now it was at 1.5% in my high yield savings account. That's guaranteed money. That seems like a great deal. Unfortunately, when you did that, you also missed out on a market, stock market, the US stock market, I think was up north of 18% or 20% in that like one time frame in 2 years. And it's like, would you rather have something that's 5% or would you rather have something that's 20%? And so people were selling out of the market, going into cash because it felt comfortable. And in hindsight, it's like, man, you know, that kind of action, because we want to feel comfortable as humans. We love certainty and we love comfortability. So our human behavior tells us to go into the comfortable place, but in reality, that's likely not going to be the optimal way to use those dollars.
Yeah, that's a good example. And there's, like, in the CFP curriculum, there are so many biases that we learn about. I think we honed in on a few that I think are super common. And a lot of them definitely can relate to investing, but they can also relate to other areas of your finance too. It's not necessarily just investing or investment biases, but one of the first ones we wrote down was recency bias. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. We have seen this play out so often the past year or so. And I don't know if it's just the fact that dentists, they love to talk to their patients about money and stock tips and other things like that, but real estate. So recency bias, just in general, is letting the very recent performance of something sway you into purchasing that one thing, assuming that it's going to do the same thing going forward. Right. So you think that, like, hey, because this did great last year, I'm going to go and buy more of it because it's going to keep going up in the same direction. But when you kind of zoom out and look at the big picture, we know that most things in finance kind of go in cycles. Right. So we know that there's something called a reversion of the mean. Not to sound too cool here, but there's a reversion of the mean to a lot of assets out there. And so when we think about real estate specifically, when some purchased real estate in 2020, when mortgage rates were 3%, sometimes even less than 3%, and prior to a 20% price increase, and they bought that single family home and they're renting it out, their expenses as a function of their interest and their mortgage balance, because the cost wasn't so high, is not the same situation as you purchasing real estate today after the 20% run up and mortgage rates at 5.5%. I don't know what they are exactly by the time this comes out, but either way, like, you can't let that recent momentum in real estate, or even we think about AI stocks. We think about all of the things that everybody loves to brag about, like, hey, I bought an Nvidia at, you know, date 3 years ago and now look at it, right? So all of these things that are like a recency bias actually tends to, like, sway us in a direction that we probably shouldn't go because the circumstances are just completely different than they were recently.
Yeah. And this can play into a lot of different topics, like not just real estate, but also like investment decisions, but also just think about funny examples too. So just to kind of elaborate. So recency bias is a tendency to kind of give a definition, tendency to place too much emphasis on experiences that are freshest in your memory or the most recent in your memory, even if they're not the most relevant or reliable at this time. Maybe a funny example would be like, and this one, I'm just literally reading this from like a Schwab article. Would you go swimming in the ocean if you just watched Jaws? Like, would you feel, I'm good.
I am so good on not swimming after watching Jaws.
Right. Like, because you recently watched that. Yesterday, if you didn't watch that movie, you probably would have done it because your family's going to the beach or whatever it is. Like, you're enjoying your day on the coastline, but then you watch Jaws and your most recent memory of something that is fun or that like a lot of people do is now tainted or like brought down to something negative. And so that can be applied to a lot of different things, like, oh, well, you know, my job recently laid off a lot of people, so I'm going to panic and stress that like I'm also going to lose my job, even though you might be very, very secure. You know, there's a lot of different examples about this, but recency bias is definitely something that can influence your financial decisions for better or for worse. And when we're talking about the bias, we're usually talking about it for like the worse, when maybe we shouldn't be relying on that recent information. Another one is confirmation bias. We see this a lot too. I think you see it in the dental space a lot. we'll talk about the behavior on that. But yeah, tell me about that.
What's the definition of that one, Megan? Because I'm interested to hear that.
Technical definition of confirmation bias is someone's tendency to process information by looking for or interpreting information that is consistent with their existing beliefs. This might be the best way to explain being biased. Like, this might be the most low-hanging fruit, like, way someone would think about being biased. Oh, well, you're only saying this because you already believe XYZ. Like, you're only finding information that confirms XYZ.
Correct. Being very selective with information, right? So it's like only seeing the view that positively spins your past actions or your past thought process.
And justifying like past actions with things like this, that could be an example of this.
Right. Yeah. And I think one of the things that really leads to success in owning a business or operating a business or growing a business is to be able to see both sides of the coin with a lot of issues, right? So for example, at SLP, like we're very feedback oriented, even if the feedback's negative, not like that negative feedback was just like an exception to, hey, we're doing everything great, right? So we're always trying to kind of make changes as we go. And it's the same thing with your financial life. I always relate this to like, you know, everybody has like a bias to their favorite sports team.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you get like the notifications on your phone about certain things, but then like you'll read an article and you'll like skip past the paragraphs that talks about the injuries to the players. And it's more along the lines of like the coach, like hyping up the team about like how we did everything great, everything like that. And how like the direction of the team's great. So you instantly think that like, hey, my team's going to be doing awesome in the future. You know, that's just a bias in itself, right? So I think we're all guilty of that with our sports teams about, hey, it's not as bad as it seems.
Yeah. Another like kind of scary thing about confirmation bias that we have definitely noticed in the past year, it's probably been going on longer, but like it's been brought to light for me recently, is like on social media. So a lot of times when you're scrolling through social media, you'll look at a post. Maybe it's controversial. Maybe it's like supporting one thing or another. And the first thing a lot of people will do is run to the comments to see like, what are other people saying about this? It is proven. And like, you could test this out with a friend or with somebody like that may have a differing opinion than you. But you look at the comments and you'll read comments that are pretty much agreeing generally with what you would agree with. Like, oh, okay, yeah, like I'm not crazy. Like these people agree with me. But then the next person will watch the exact same post or look at the same post and look at their comment section that shows up on any of the social media platforms. It'll show you like recent stuff or like it'll kind of curate the comments, like the most relevant. I think that's how they call it. And the next person who looks at the same post, reads the comments, there will be comments that are supporting more so what they think. And it's the algorithm. The algorithm is figuring you out. It knows like what you like, what you slow down and actually read, what you skip over. It picks up these things over time with your like usage. And so this is a really scary part of confirmation bias, where you might continuously be in this loop for anything. It could be like how you think you should be frying chicken. You know, there could be varying opinions on that. But like you might be in this constant loop of, oh, well, the way I think I fried chicken is right. And everybody else thinks that too. But then like your neighbor is seeing a different thing and it's confirming theirs. So
and then you walk out in their backyard and they have a fryer out there, and then you walk over and they're not doing it right at all.
Yeah.
Right.
It's very different. So that's really fascinating, where like confirmation bias, it can really narrow in our opinion or our thoughts on something. And this can definitely relate into finance in a lot of different ways, but that's kind of the most mainstream thing that like popped in my head when we started talking about this. I was like, ah, that's kind of a scary part of confirmation bias.
So lesson learned, click into the comments that don't support your view. So that way you have a nice neutral social media experience.
Yeah. Instead of most relevant, maybe switch to like most recent or oldest or something, or like keep scrolling, you know?
Right.
Really, really fascinating stuff. Now, another bias, kind of moving on down the line, we made a list and I added this one in here, but overconfidence bias. I think we see this a lot too, in different ways. I'll read the definition and you tell me what you think about it. So overconfidence bias is the tendency to overestimate our knowledge and abilities in certain areas. Let's talk about this one.
So do you want me to bring the finance take to it?
Yes, let's do that.
All right. So we have a lot of folks that come to us with a stock portfolio of a bunch of individual stocks. And it's great in our financial planning tool because we can see what they purchased the stock for and what it's worth today, right? So you can see the cost basis versus the value. There's some stocks out there that did exceptionally well. And folks love to talk about, you know, their home runs, their stocks that went up 3X, et cetera, you know. And so that is a form of overconfidence bias because you all of a sudden think that, hey, you hit one home run or maybe two or three out of 10, you are all of a sudden a bona fide home run hitter. You should be batting third in the lineup. You should quit your day job and now become a stock trader because you know exactly what you're doing because look at all the money you made. So that is a form of overconfidence bias because of which maybe you had, let's be honest, like you had bought the stock at the right time, whether you were scrolling social media and that's the comment supported that, you know, by buying the stock or whatever it is.
Confirmation bias. Recency bias, what's going on in the market right now.
Exactly. But does that mean necessarily that you're all of a sudden an all-star stock trader? Likely not, because we talk about reversion to the mean. We talk about, hey, we probably want to start to chip away out of things that have done really well over a short period of time to try to bring it back to like a less concentration, all of these things that we learn in the CFP textbook of reasons why you maybe want to sell that position, but overconfidence bias says, no, I'm holding on to this because I know exactly what I'm doing because we did so well, you know, in the past 6 months.
Yeah. And in overconfidence bias, like you could probably think about like examples in your own workplace where like this happens, where maybe a practitioner was overconfident that they could perform this specific task or this thing, and you know that maybe you're going to be better at it, or maybe somebody else in the room is better at it, but somebody's really overconfident in themselves, thinking that they could just jump in and you know, that's kind of a, I don't know the technical terms of these things, but that's an example. Overconfidence could be in a lot of different areas of your finance, like you know better. These sometimes go hand in hand, overconfidence and confirmation bias, because we will get folks in the financial planning space that they've been doing their finances on their own. Also, I don't know why I keep saying finances, kind of weird. I feel like I've said it like seven different ways today. Sorry for the weirdness.
Finance. Oh, sorry.
Finance. So, but I think confirmation bias and overconfidence sometimes go hand in hand because we'll get folks that want us to check their stuff, which is totally fine. Like I totally understand that, like wanting a second pair of eyes on it. You know, maybe they were hesitant for a long time to even do this because of overconfidence bias. Like, I think I've got it. I think I understand what I'm doing. And then confirmation bias, you know, maybe they had already been doing research on that particular thing and it was confirming that, yes, they're right. Not to say that you're not right. Like, that's not the case. That's not what I'm trying to say. But sometimes when we're working with somebody who just wants like a second look, that's all they want. And then, you know, that they've got what they wanted and they're out. So like those folks sometimes are better for a like one-time fee financial planning experience where it's more so just like confirming, hey, yep, you're doing the right things versus like an ongoing relationship, because there's different like engagements you can have with financial planners. Our engagement tends to be the relationship side of things. It's an ongoing process, where there are other planners out there that will do hourly, or you'll pay like a one-time fee just for kind of like a consultation type of conversation.
Yeah. It's amazing how different people are, like the spectrum of the way people think about it. Because I think there's just naturally like delegate people that love to just like say, hey, you guys go do this for me. I don't even want to think about this. And then there's like the validators that you're talking about have like just want to validate, confirm that everything's going on that should be going on. And then there's like purely DIYers. Like I will look everything up on their own, still have a bunch of emotional biases when they go through this typically because they're humans just like us, but then they'll DIY it and they don't want any help, right? So it's kind of cool to see the spectrum, and you know, everyone has a certain way of going about it.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing to be a DIYer. I think having a check every so often, kind of like you go to the doctor for a checkup, like I think that's totally appropriate. This isn't something that you went to school for or that you do every single day. Everybody does have a financial planner, whether you acknowledge it or not. It's either you or it's somebody you're delegating it to or somebody you're working with collaboratively, you know, on your finances. So again, there's not a downside to being a DIYer, but there could be reason to have checkups every so often to make sure, like, just to check yourself on, am I doing the right things? Am I thinking about things the right way? Because things change. Like, you might have that 1 hour conversation with a professional. They confirm everything that you're doing is good. But next year, you know, something changes in the investment horizon or something changes in your life. And it might be good to have another conversation.
Right.
So continuing down the list, there's only a couple more that we really thought were important to mention, but very common examples. I think you'll understand what we mean when we say it, but herd mentality or kind of having FOMO. So fear of missing out. This is the person's tendency to follow or copy what other investors or other people are doing. So that's GameStop. A common bias. Yeah, GameStop, exactly. There's also fight or flight. When markets are down, you know, that's when sometimes folks will completely pull everything out because they're scared. Like, that's flighting. And then fighting would be sticking it through, like continuing through, sticking with the plan, even if it feels scary because the markets are down.
This is one of the most human nature, just when we were like cave people out there, like trying to survive with shelter and the very starting stages of humanity. This is what had us survive is, hey, when we sense fear, when we sense danger, we're going to run away and we're going to fight against it, but we're going to take some sort of action. In reality, it's supposed to be the opposite in the portfolio. If the market's down, you're not going to run away from it because you might sell at the bottom, or you're not going to like take a bunch of action because this is what you're prepared for in taking on the risk in the portfolio, right? So yeah, it's kind of crazy. It's supposed to be the opposite of what your human nature is telling us.
Mm-hmm. And that's where like behavior totally comes into play here. There's also sunk cost fallacy, which we see quite a bit, which is where a person is reluctant to abandon a strategy or a course of action or sell a position, for example, that they've invested heavily in when it's clear that maybe the abandonment of that action would be more beneficial. And it's because they're holding on to just getting back to where they were, or they're holding on to the idea that it will rebound or something when maybe
it will come back, Megan. It will come back.
Right. So sometimes we have to chat through those things like, you know, this is not going to change, or this is probably not something to hold on to, or there are better things we can do to diversify, to rebound from this in maybe a different way than you were thinking.
Right.
I think those are some of the big biases that we commonly see that we could recognize. I think this conversation is more about recognition, knowing when those things are coming into play, and just making sure that if it is influencing your decision, you're thinking about it, you're understanding that it's influencing your decision.
Yeah. Like, to Megan, in your opinion, like, you've worked with, you know, hundreds of clients, and what are some ways, just like really quick, that we can try to combat these human biases, these emotional tendencies in your execution?
Well, so on the investing side, like, I really like the dollar cost averaging strategy, where when we're investing, we're putting money towards retirement, we're putting money towards a goal, but it's invested. Like, we never know when the right time to buy is. So instead of dumping money in when we think it's the right time to buy, to go in and purchase, we really just spread out like our contributions on an ongoing basis. So kind of building it into our cash flow. So that way, like, every month we're contributing about the same no matter what. So the market might be down, which is great because we're buying on sale. The market might be up. That's okay because we're paying the same amount. We're buying less, but we're not dumping money in that month. So mathematically, dollar cost averaging over time can really help your average cost of investing, making sure that you're taking emotions out of it. So that's a really great way we could do that.
Another key thing you said there was, no matter what, you're putting money in, even if it's down, even if it's up. So it's automation, just by definition, is removing emotions from the equation. All you're doing is pressing a button to say, every month I'm going to contribute this amount, or every week. I like to tie it up with paychecks, because I like to invest in accounts just like a 401k contribution, like, time it up with paychecks. It's still insight. I like to say out of sight, out of mind, but it's still insight because it does hit your checking account, like when you get paid. But if it goes out the same day, you know, then it's kind of like a 401k contribution, but it's not into a 401k. And so I love that strategy because people can think of it. And that's why a 401k tends to be the largest asset of outside of home equity for the general population, is because they don't touch it. They just automate into it and they kind of check in every quarter. And it's like, wow, I'm a 401k millionaire. And all I did was just press a button when I first got hired.
Yeah, it's automated and it's automatically dollar cost averaging. So a lot of people are already doing this. This is taking the behavior out of it. Another couple quick ways to maybe avoid some of these biases is, you know, get varying opinions on things. This might be another example, like don't just watch Fox News or don't just watch CNN, like get varying opinions on, you know, your financial decisions. And know when you need help too, like overconfidence bias, like know when maybe this isn't your area of expertise and you might need to chat with somebody about the nuances of what you're trying to do to make sure that you got the right idea. We see this a lot in student loan planning too, where somebody originally, you know, put together their student loan plan and they thought it was a great plan, but they didn't realize XYZ that could have saved them a ton of time and a ton of money. And they weren't getting the advice in the very beginning because they thought they had the right idea and they were confident in their plan until they weren't.
I also see this with contributing to Roth IRAs. They didn't know that they were phased out. And so we have to do a lot of rewind work of like, hey, how do we remove those contributions?
That's very true.
Not to go too off on a tangent, but that's a very, very, very common problem that we see.
Yeah, Roth IRA issues for sure. And then like herd mentality, like pretty much if something's exciting in the market, turns out the news is already out. Like you're going to be buying at a high. So you're already losing.
CNBC's news is not your friend. So yeah. as much as you like to see like the stock ticker that goes along the bottom of the screen there, that is meant for you to, your dopamine levels are higher because you see the action. It makes you want to buy stocks. It makes you want to trade. And we know that that's not the long-term answer.
Yeah, it's telling you what's already happened. This is where we're already at. If you were on this boat, this is where you would have been. But that's not the time to like jump into whatever it's doing. And then sunk cost fallacy. Like I think sometimes you just got to rip off the Band-Aid and move forward. Water under the bridge. Like we can't cry about what we did before. We've just got to get it right and move forward from here. So I think those are some quick tips. And then like lastly, just having another opinion in the room, having an accountability partner. So that could be your spouse, that could be a friend, that could be an advisor, someone else to moderate your decisions, your kind of direct your questions, like get you on the right track and call out when maybe some of these biases are happening so we can correct. That could be helpful.
Love that. So a lot of people think like a financial planner is like there to make you money per se, like get you in the right investments, et cetera. But if they're also there to avoid that next big mistake, that's a kind of like prevention, like a blind spot that you weren't even thinking about. And that in the form of cost savings is something that's like a phantom cost. You can't even see that cost, but it ends up being a huge cost saver in the long run.
Yeah. It's kind of like preventative care on an ongoing basis versus reactive care, fixing what's already like messed up or what's already going on, just kind of remedying the issue. So having a proactive partner in the mix to help you just move things along in the right direction and avoid mistakes, catch biases, save money, all the good things. Well, thanks for chatting with me today about behavior and the emotional side of finance. I think this was a really good conversation.
Thanks for having me. And I'm looking forward to maybe doing a bonfire with you, Megan.
Heck yeah. We're going to bring the charcuterie.
That's right. And I can show you like my wife's crazy marshmallow roasting method.
Well, you guys have a great weekend. Maybe have a bonfire. Be safe. Try some cool s'mores variations or this new charcuterie idea. We totally will be. And we'll catch you on the next one.
What if you could get fiduciary financial planning specific to your profession that's student loan aware that could change your life for a price much better than you ever dreamed possible? If that sounds good to you, go to slpwealth.com/pod for a free, no obligation 15-minute intro call with one of our own fiduciary financial planners to see if we could be a good fit for you. This podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered individualized investment advice. If a specific investment is mentioned, do not consider it a recommendation to buy or sell the investment. Seek first advice from a financial professional before implementing any strategies discussed. All investments involve risk, and past performance does not guarantee future results. Yay, compliance.